Here at the Sociology of Everything podcast, we acknowledge the people of Gonayarta, whose land this episode was mainly produced on, and whose past and present elders we pay our respects to. Hey everyone, I'm Eric Hsu.
And I'm Louis Evers.
And we're Lou and the Hsu, and this is the Sociology of Everything podcast, brought to you by UniSA, the university that has a lot of students.
It's kind of hard to tell at the moment because we had a period where students have been on campus and off campus in response to COVID and everything. So I feel like one day I come in and there's no one around. I'm like, we don't have any students. And the next day, suddenly it's packed again. I'm like, wow.
You realize how many students UniSA has at graduation ceremonies.
Yes.
Where are all these people coming from? It's nuts. It's like thousands and thousands.
I wonder if there are a few cheeky students who it's like, that's one of their first times on campus. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if a student came up to me in their full graduation get up and was like, can you tell me where I go to get to like the gym?
Is this UniSA?
Yeah, that's right.
In this episode, we're going to look at the work of George Ritzer and Nathan Jurgensen, specifically their article in the Journal of Consumer Culture titled Production, Consumption, and Prosumption. And this is a pretty fascinating piece because this is their attempt to track how capitalism may have changed in recent years. Because a central premise of this article is that the capitalism of today is different than from the capitalism of yesteryear. So the capitalism experienced and described by Marx and Engels, by Max Weber, by the Frankfurt School in the 1950s is somehow different from the capitalism experienced in the 21st century. In what ways is that so, Louis?
Well, to go back to the earliest form of capitalism, the one that was examined by Marx and Engels, let's say, the central process that was driving capitalism, that was driving growth, that was at the heart of societies in the day was production. It was the development of factories. It was developing of new and innovative ways to produce goods. And then that rippled through all the rest of the social fabric. It changed where people lived. It changed what people did on a daily basis. It was all driven by what work people would have. And that was all oriented about how things were being produced in society.
So in early capitalism, people focused the heck out of production. How are things produced? In what ways? What's unique? At what scales are things being produced? And indeed, this was also an important marker of identity. It very much mattered how you produce things because that would determine your position and your status in life.
I mean, thinking about Marx's work, the means of production and someone's role within the means of production, that was it for them, really. You'd be a worker. It'd determine your class. It would determine your life opportunities. It would determine how you thought about yourself and your fellow individuals in society.
And then something changes, though, in the 20th century. Some people begin noting that maybe production loses its prominence and there's a new thing about capitalism that becomes more prominent. What is that other thing, Louis?
Well, that other thing's what happens to goods after they've been produced and they go out into the world and then they're bought. It's the consumption side of it.
Yeah. So it's the other side of the coin.
Exactly. And this became more central to everything. So if we think about some of the examples you gave before in terms of the actual organization of cities and buildings and things, the places in which consumption was happening suddenly became much more central and important. Shopping centers and districts and these things. The factories sort of lost their centrality to how we think about cities. And the shopping center became much more significant. And
so if you meet someone for the first time, you usually ask questions like, what do you do? But that only gets you part of the way there, isn't it now?
Well, and this goes back to another example you gave before in terms of identities and things. What your job is and what you do for a living, your role within the production processes of society. People argued around this second transition that you're discussing that that was less important and now it was more important what you consumed. And prior to asking you, Eric, what do you do for a living, I've probably already looked at your clothing, I've kind of sussed you out a little bit. And what I'm kind of judging is what you buy. What are your consumption practices? How do you purchase things to construct your identity? And that's sort of a big way of how we define ourselves and position ourselves in the world now. What do we purchase?
Yeah, and that makes sense, isn't it? I mean, if you look at online dating apps, how are people portraying themselves? Mm. They don't just simply talk about what is it that they do. I mean, some people might mention that, you know, they're a doctor or they're a tradesman or something, but they're more likely to tell you what television show they're into.
Mm. Absolutely. What cultural things are they consuming?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a much bigger identity marker these days, I'd suggest.
Yeah. And whether or not pineapple belongs on pizza.
Absolutely. And interestingly, for this reading as well, because they talk about how the forms of exploitation in society that Marx and Engels are so focused on were so orientated on production, on what people being paid for their labor and whether that was fair. And obviously for Marx, it wasn't fair. But then when you look to the consumption side of things, there's whole new forms of exploitation that can center on consumption, just like making people pay too much for goods. It's another way in which people from a lower class can lose out and be exploited by the capitalist system.
So we have production, we have consumption, and there's also this third term that combines the previous two called prosumption. Can we give an example of what prosumption is about, Louis?
I think the great thing about prosumption is it is what it sounds like it is. You know, what's the saying? If it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's probably a duck. And so it's just any practice that combines a production process with a consumption process. Mm. So the obvious examples are where consumers are made to be involved in producing the very things they're consuming.
Yeah.
So I'll give you one example. My most hated example of prosumption is at Vietnamese restaurants where you order cold rolls and you have to roll your own cold rolls because I'm rubbish at it. I put holes in that light rice paper. I end up with just a kind of salad-y mess on my plate. I'm like, it's not for me. I'm happy to pay someone to do it. I want to go in there as a pure consumer and pay someone to produce this item that I will then hand over cash for. I don't want to be involved in the production of my lunch when I'm ordering cold rolls.
And you can see how presumption is involved in capitalism. It's a way to generate profit, right? Like when you go into that Vietnamese restaurant, are they paying you for constructing your own roll?
No. They're certainly not. But
now, that's a good example. Another example is actually given by Ritzer himself in some of his previous work around the theory of McDonaldization, when he talks about how people bust their own tables in McDonald's and other fast food restaurants. They don't get paid for that. You know, when someone takes their tray back to wherever trays need to go, it's not like all of a sudden the manager of the McDonald's comes out and says, "Thank you very much. Here's $5, you know, come back next week and there'll be more if you do keep doing that." There's not. It's a way to basically get labor performed at zero cost.
And it's definitely one of those concepts where as soon as you learn it, you think, oh, hang on, I do this all day. Every time I go to an ATM machine, instead of actually having someone organize my bank accounts for me on the other side, every time I go to a self-service checkout at a shopping center.
When you get petrol.
Yeah. Well, I remember when I was really young and mum used to go and get petrol, I'd be in the car. It was standard for someone to come out and pump it for you. There was a specific self-service Bowser, I reckon, but the rest weren't. Whereas now it's like presumption is just part of the process of getting petrol.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Now, you might think, and indeed Ritzer and Jurgensen note this, that this is kind of the story of capitalism. First, there was a big emphasis on production. Then it became more about consumption. And then we live in a prosumer capitalist world. But they actually disagree. They think prosumption has always existed. However, they do think that there is something unique about capitalism. And more specifically, they do think the nature of prosumption may have changed. Louis, can you tell us about what they're trying to get at here?
Well, I think there are two parts to it. Firstly, when they look back at the presumption that's occurred within capitalism in the past, it's still largely an exploitative process. Mm. It's about business owners thinking, I can't extract any more surplus value from workers. My workers already are paid the minimum they need to survive.
Yeah.
How do I make more money? I know, I'll make my consumers also do some of the work. So the reason is that the context has changed. The context in which presumption occurs now includes all of these new digital tools, these new digital environments, Web 2.0, and we can discuss exactly what that is in a sec. But essentially, when this text looks at contemporary presumption, it's often looking at what we do online.
Yeah,
it's looking
that's
at
right.
how we're involved in Facebook and Reddit and everything else. And can you describe that as exploitation? I'm not sure.
Yeah, and this actually hits at the core of their argument, that prosumer capitalism has changed, and it may be changing in four specific ways. The first, according to them, is the inability of capitalists to control contemporary prosumers and the greater resistance to the incursions of capitalism. What are they trying to argue with this particular point?
So what they're referring to there is a lot of the presumption that occurs online, if we think about creating your own Wikipedia pages or uploading your own YouTube clips. Those activities aren't directly controlled by the kind of capitalist system or by business owners, whoever within the capitalist system. They're more than just sort of free actions of individuals participating online and doing what they want to do online. And they give a couple of reasons for this. I mean, one reason they give is that the internet itself developed and user participation developed with this ethic of freedom and non-government intervention and this sort of stuff. But they say even, you know, contemporary users don't necessarily know or care about that. The reality is the internet is just a good space for collaboration. It's a good space for individuals to be able to participate and do what they want. And so because of that, it's not the same form of presumption that we've seen in the past, where it was really directed and controlled by powerful players within the capitalist system.
Yeah. It's a bit more of an open sandbox.
Yeah, that's right.
Whereas if you think about presumption at a McDonald's, there's a clear script to follow. But on the internet, it's a bit more open-ended.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bit more open-ended in terms of the things you can do, the things you can create, and things you can engage with. I'm sure there are weird things people do online. Right?
Is this the point where we go through one of those browsing histories? That's right. Yeah. Delete history.
And it's not just simply that capitalists can't control consumers as much as they can offline. What also might be unique about digital presumption is that it may not entirely be exploitative. Like, you can see how McDonald's asking people to bus their tables, which also occurs at IKEA, a supermarket company expecting customers to scan and check out their own groceries is somewhat exploitative in that it just basically receives the profits from that and doesn't give much back, or directly back anyways. But that's kind of less the case with presumptive acts online. And I should mention that Ritzer and Jurgensen aren't just talking about like the internet writ large. I mean, to some extent they are, but they're responding to an environment that we're now more or less familiar with. This is the environment online of Web 2.0 web platforms. And it probably sounds old hat now, but when they were writing in the first decade of the new millennium, it was all quite exciting. This was the time of the advent of YouTube, of Facebook, where content online became a lot more user-generated. And by the way, can I just say that when I teach some of my first-year students now who were born around the year 2000 or a little later than that, they cannot envision a world where there wasn't YouTube. And I distinctly remember, like, when it came out, there was this thing called YouTube.
I remember having conversations. I remember someone telling me about it. I remember learning that it was a thing, and someone's like, it's amazing. You've got to see it. You want any video on the world, it's there. Whoa.
And what distinguishes apps and platforms like YouTube from what came before it was, before, there was a more traditional model of content delivery and consumption. right? People would sign up to services like America Online. You've got mail. Mm. I really hope I don't get sued. I for a copyright infringement. And by the way, that was my own voice. If you're listening, you know, AOL people. But previously, you would sign on to a service. You would consume the content they provide you. Mm. And it kind of more or less, you know, functioned like a bit more of an interactive form of television. Mm. But now the people generating the content in which people are consuming are also consumers themselves, but they are just anyone off the street.
Mm. I mean, it's kind of interesting to think about your own internet usage and think, what percentage of the content that I read and consume is generated by some kind of clear business entity, so like a news web page, yeah, or something like that. And what percentage are the comments of other private citizens out there?
Just some random person.
Yeah, like people's Instagram feeds, people's Facebook pages.
Well, I mean, even if you're consuming something that's produced by a large company, you might also be reading like the comments about that thing.
Yeah.
Which are written by anyone and everyone.
Yeah. And I think the reason Web 2.0 isn't really that much of an interesting term anymore is because this is like just the internet now. This is just how anyone, like, I mean, that's a great example. The news webpage is itself now an example of Web 2.0 because of the comments feed.
Yeah.
But to go back to your initial point there about, is this exploitative?
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, it's such an interesting question, and it's one they kind of leave open a little bit in this text, mm, because they point out that we can't really consider it exploitative in a traditional sense because, A, we enjoy doing it to some extent, right?
Yeah.
People, when we're doing this, when we're consuming Instagram, or at least some people do. I hate Instagram, but some people enjoy it. So it's kind of something that we do as part of our leisure activities, as part of what we want to do in life, this consumption or this prosumption process. So how is that exploitative?
Yeah, well, I mean, if you compare it with prosumption in the offline world, how many people would miss, I don't know, having to like press buttons in a McDonald's when they order stuff? I don't think that many. I don't think anyone would be like, oh, I remember the days when we used to bus our own tables where we couldn't just leave all of our dishes. They don't use dishes at McDonald's, but yeah, when we left
the plastic trays.
Yeah, we used to leave our plastic trays and wrappers on the table after we finished eating. I don't think that many people would miss that, but I would say if you took the right to prosume online from people, I think that some people would be really upset.
Mm. And I suppose another part of it as well, and this is referred to in the reading again, is the fact that there's less clear lines of exploitation in terms of who's making money out of it. When it comes to presumption in terms of doing your own groceries at the checkout, it's very obvious. The business is saving on money because they don't have to employ someone to do the work because you're doing the work. But with a lot of online presumption, say a Reddit forum where people are commenting on one another, it's less obvious, it's less visible how someone is making money out of your presumption.
Ritzer and Jurgensen do note, though, that there are exploitative elements, especially of Web 2.0 technologies. And we can clearly see this on numerous platforms. People generate content for a company. People consume that content. And yet they oftentimes don't get paid, but the company sure does.
Yeah. Every click, every advertisement that is involved in the production and consumption of that content is generating income for someone.
Yeah. However, they still leave open the idea that presumption is entirely exploitative. So they do know exploitation happens. They just think it's a bit more complicated and you can't make blatant statements that it either is or it isn't exploitative. The third distinct quality about digital presumption is the possibility of the emergence of a whole new economic form. And what I think they're trying to argue here is that capitalism itself might be challenged in some ways by what's going on in the digital world, in that there are some people producing things, but for no profit, or at least no visible immediate profit. So you might think of something here like Wikipedia. People are producing a resource for others, and yet no money outside of operating costs are actually being generated. Or another good example, I think, is VLC, the video playing app, which has just been released for free. And as far as I can tell, the app has been released not for a profit-based motive. And also you can think of like illegal downloads as well. You know, like when people quote unquote steal, if we can use that term in inverted commas, from these large companies, content that they would normally otherwise pay for.
So the summary of that is simply that the internet is providing the opportunity for people to engage in more and more activities that don't fit the traditional model of capitalism, that don't fit the traditional model of you're producing something to be consumed, or you're consuming something that's being produced, or you're involved in a bit of both of them. All of a sudden, there's all these activities that are for no profit. Yeah. They're just for the enjoyment of it or for some other purpose.
Yeah. Again, they keep emphasizing that money's still made on the internet. Web 2.0 companies still can be profitable. But there is this other side of the internet that seems to be kind of anti-capitalist.
Mm.
Or at least the possibility is there. You know, and again, I feel like the points they're trying to make here and in some other parts of the text is that these issues perhaps are more open-ended. They don't necessarily come down hard on one side or the other.
Mm.
But there is this possibility that capitalism could be challenged.
I mean, it is interesting to go back to the other side of the argument with the illegal downloads, for instance. If you think about what's actually happened with that, the businesses came up with a new model of, you know, the Netflix and the Spotify and the kind of rental style of ownership, and they made it so convenient that they've kind of won the day a bit on the download aspect. So they found a way to re-commodify that process.
Yes. It's so complicated now to download illegally files, movies, music.
And it's so easy to do it legally with all the streaming
services.
So maybe
capitalism might not find its end online. The last unique feature of digital presumption that Ritzer and Jurgensen discuss in their article is the idea that prosumer capitalism may be based on abundance rather than scarcity, and effectiveness rather than efficiency. And this leads us actually to a section we like to call Say What? Which is when we look at a quote in need of further explanation. Ritzer and Jurgensen write, "Prosumer capitalism is based on a system where content is abundant and created by those not on the payroll." Later on in the paragraph, they write, "In an abundant market, companies are less concerned with such things as maximizing the efficiency of producing and the quantity of output. When scarcity is removed from the equation, efficiency with respect to content becomes less important." What are they trying to say here?
Well, the first thing they're trying to say is simply that within this new presumption and online presumption environment, one of the key things that happens is that people produce and consume a lot. There's just a lot of stuff being produced and consumed. And that's kind of one of the selling points for something. When you go to Spotify, you know, one of the things you want to know is how many songs are going to be available. I want the biggest possible library. I want new things to be added on a regular basis. And it's the same with Wikipedia. It's the same with any kind of presumption environment you can think of. It's defined by having heaps of stuff. It's not about scarcity.
Hmm.
And if you think about earlier forms of kind of production or consumption within capitalism, scarcity played a much more significant role.
Like you go into a supermarket and if there's loads of stuff that's not being sold, right? Not being consumed, that's a problem.
Yeah.
And indeed, you can see on YouTube loads of videos that probably get like 2 views.
Mm.
Probably there are some episodes of podcasts that don't ever get listened to, and this might be one of them. Louis, we might be one of those people that are prosumers, right? That are producing content that no one's listening to. Mm. And how sad for us.
It'd be nice if we're analyzing kind of the breakdown between scarcity and value as we all provide further evidence of that by adding our content into our various available
But that's the
formats.
Point, right? Like when we got our podcast listed on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and Google Podcasts. No one like listened to our podcast first and said, actually, this is of a decent quality. Mm. We could, I mean, I would like to think, Louis, that we produce a pretty decent product. But if this was a dumpster fire, they would still just keep it on the books. Because maybe it would be so bad, it would be good. Which is very much oftentimes what I think of a lot of the celebrity impressions that I do.
The rumor podcast.
But the point Ritzer and Jurgensen are trying to make is that it's all about abundance. It's scarcity doesn't mean that much in the era of Web 2.0 technologies. It's about trying to get as much content on your platform as much as possible. And indeed, if you look at the statistics from YouTube about how many videos are uploaded a day, every hour, every minute, it's shocking. Mm. It's genuinely very, very shocking. Mm-hmm. And I also really like their point that it's about effectiveness rather than efficiency. So you don't have to worry so much about things being hits anymore. You just need to make sure that stuff is on there.
That's good news for us.
That's right. That's right. I don't necessarily know if the podcasts we produce are ever efficient. No,
probably not. Well, speaking of efficiency.
Yeah, there's been too much abundance.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we need to go back to a more traditional version of capitalism to finish this off, I think.
Indeed. Yeah, well, thanks very much. Catch you another episode.
See you later.
The Sociology of Everything podcast is created and hosted by Eric Hsu and Louis Evers. It's produced and edited by Eric Hsu, with special assistance from UniSA Online and UniSA Justice Society. To learn more about studying sociology and other programs online or in person at the University of South Australia, visit unisa.edu.au, where you can search for more details. The Sociology of Everything podcast is primarily recorded on the lands of the Kaurna people. The hosts of the podcast would like to pay their respects to elders past, present, and emerging. If you'd like to get in touch or learn more about the podcast, visit our website at sociologypodcast.com. Thanks for listening.